For those of you out in our listening audience, I really am sorry you are missing the spectacle that has marched into our studio. Jim Galloway, accompanied by at least a dozen Scottish
members of the Fife and Drum.
Fife and Drummers. He, of course, clad in his kilt with the Galloway family plaid. What do you call that plaid? Tartan.
Tartan, there you go. Yeah.
Tartan. He is back from Scotland, and we got him in the studio. I loved your, you know, the way you just marched in here. It's nice to have you back.
Well, you know, I got great legs. I'll show them off.
I'll attest to that.
Real quick, 2 weeks in Scotland, you had a great trip.
I recommend it.
Okay.
Every time.
And because, and of course, we all know Jim Galloway is the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and his column appears on Thursdays and Sundays in the Dead Tree edition, and you're writing a column kind of based on your trip that for Sunday.
Yeah,
give us
a
quick preview.
Yeah, just basically how Brexit has really killed off the Scottish independence movement for right now.
Well, that's an odd thing to say, because we thought for a while that after the Brexit vote happened, that in fact, Scotland might renew its effort to separate itself.
But the first divorce is overcoming the second divorce, if you will.
All right, we'll look for that in your column on Sunday, but it really is wonderful. We missed you for those 2 weeks, Jim. And Loretta Lepore, a Republican strategist and a government affairs lobbyist. That's fair. You don't mind the term lobbyist, do you?
That's okay. That's okay.
Government affairs operative.
Political strategist.
You often work with business organizations on major policy issues,
yes.
Transportation being one of your areas of real expertise.
Yes,
fair enough?
That's very accurate and fair.
All right. And joining us from the Washington Bureau of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Tamar Hallerman. Tamar, you don't get the parade Galloway does, but we're sure glad you're here.
I can't stop thinking about kilts now.
We're really glad you're with us, Tamar. I would like to say you've had a slightly quiet week because Congress isn't in session, but is that a not fair characterization? Have you been pretty busy up there despite that?
The White House has kept us pretty busy this week.
Okay. And we will. That's what I thought. We'll get into that in a little while. But I do want to start with the 6th District race. Let's start locally because we'll later talk about the Paris speech that the president gave, the fact that Jim Comey is going to testify in the week ahead. But let's start with the 6th. Jim Galloway, there's a new poll out, WSB-TV, done by our occasional panelist,
Mark Roundtree
at Landmark Communications. And it shows us what we've been hearing from other polls. This race is a dead heat.
Yeah, it had Ossoff at 51%, over the 50% mark. Karen Handel a couple points behind, but within the margin of error. This is what you would call a statistical dead heat right now.
Does that surprise you, Loretta?
I think that it is surprising in that when, you know, this race first became a race, when it came open, certainly nobody thought it was going to be this close. And certainly when the candidates started entering the field and you looked at the field of Democrats, you certainly didn't think that there would be somebody who could position themselves to that type of lead.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it has been an eye-opener for Republicans in a lot of ways. And there is absolutely nothing being taken for granted in this race.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jim.
Just the Roundtree poll, I thought was interesting in that it showed Ossoff really penetrating among your mid-range voters, all the way up to 64 years old, from the mid-40s to 64. And that should be prime Republican territory right there.
Yeah.
Well, and you have, I think the other part of that poll was that Karen is trending better with men,
mm-hmm.
and Ossoff is trending better with women, which I think is something folks didn't anticipate either.
That's the Trump effect.
The Trump effect, right, and probably some of the positioning when you look at the middle, the independent voters in the district, in the middle of the moderate Republicans, and some of the social issues, so reproductive rights issues, you know, but nevertheless, having a female candidate in a congressional race is something that Republicans have been looking for a very long time.
Yeah. Hey, Tamar, news that Karen Handel's campaign had accepted 4 debates, and they're coming up next week, a few of them, broke on our show on Wednesday. It happened right before we went on the air. And I want to revisit a question that I asked when the news broke that they'd accepted the 4 debates. My question was, is this a sign? 4 is a lot of debates. It struck me that the Handel campaign, which had not been responding, Ossoff has said all along he'd do 6 of them. The Handel people have been silent on this subject for some time. This is one of those situations where if you felt you just wanted to play defense to some extent, you accept one debate and then you say, yes, of course we're doing a debate, and you leave it at that. But the fact that they accepted 4, and I'm going to start with you, Tamar, I'm not sure I get it other than to say this is a sign of how close the race is and the Handel people thinking they need all the exposure they can get to try to pull this out. You, all 3 of you, starting with you, Tamar, help me figure this out.
Yeah, free publicity. I mean, by some accounts, John Ossoff has outspent Karen Handel in terms of ads 7-1 by some that I've seen. That's a huge disadvantage. So this is a great way to get out there, get your message out for free, look voters through the through the television screen and try and get them that way. And to top it off, the CNN debate might be a national one. So a really great way to get donors from across the country to help with that final push. So why not?
Yeah, no, the CNN one, I'm not sure that Ossoff has actually acceded to that one, which
would
be unusual.
So they have not quite yet gotten to the 4. They've accepted 3 to the best of your knowledge. There's been some question about that for the last couple of days.
But Lorana, you tell me what you think about this. I think if Karen Handel is at the point right now, just given that this the WSB landmark poll, she's at the point now where if she only does 1 debate and there's a glitch in there, then she is risking something very, very big. If you presumably with 4 debates. You're going to kind of walk over any mistakes you make in the first one or the second one, and you're going to build up a little bit more expertise as you move on.
Right. I think what's so critical about these 4 debates is the timing, with 3 weeks left in the election. Right. I mean, they're piled on one another.
Yeah, the first one is next Tuesday at WSB TV Channel 2.
Right. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Then there's one on the 8th. Right. On the 8th.
Right.
Which is the WPBA, WABE debate. Is that right?
I'd have to go back and look.
All right. The point is there's 2 next week.
Right. And so I think, you know, historically, to Tamara's point, is that, you know, Karen Handel has leveraged media well in previous races where she has not been able to raise as much money as her opponents in primaries and so forth. And she's always been effective in utilizing the media and debates to leverage her position in that race. In this situation, it's going to be a matter of, because of the tightness of them, there is going to have to be immense message discipline. And their rapid response teams are going to have to be on it, because both of them have something to risk. But John Ossoff has a very large amount of money that he could turn something on a dime if there is a misstep. And, you know, Karen's team could do the same. But if you're allocating all of your resources to these debates, to your rapid response team, to your messaging team, and you've got your candidate locked down in debates, who's working on the get out the vote? Right. So you've got to make sure that those teams are very well entrenched in the community and in the district, getting those votes out while all of this is happening at the same time. Because at the end of the day, this is where that race is being won. Who's going to turn out the most voters and who's going to capture the middle?
Tamar, obviously, the national media picked up on this race weeks and weeks ago. It's become a big story in the New York Times, Washington Post, all the other major national publications. Is there still a lot of buzz about the race on the Hill? Are Democrats, do they remain excited that they think they can win this thing? Tell us how people up there are dealing with the race at this point.
Absolutely. So I have my little workspace in the Senate that's that's absolutely teensy. And normally I can kind of hide out there. The Georgia delegation mostly goes under the radar, so I kind of have them all to myself. But lately, the last few weeks in particular, all my friends who work for national outlets coming up to me saying, you know, what's going on with this race? Tell me about this race. What do I need to know?
Who can I call? Give me some phone numbers.
Exactly. A lot, you know, I see a lot more people waiting to talk to Johnny Isaacson and David Perdue to get their thoughts on the race. People are very much paying attention.
It's interesting. I've thought from the very beginning that Democrats should be careful about building expectations. It is a Republican district. I know Ossoff's done well, but it remains basically a Republican district. And I've thought for a long time that Democrats shouldn't, in fact, be so shouldn't express so openly their excitement they might win the race, because why do you build that expectation, you know?
Well,
if you win it, great.
Right, especially after what's happened in Montana and elsewhere.
Yeah, you've got to win one of them somewhere.
Yeah, so there's immense pressure on the Democratic machine. But if I can point to we're missing Todd Rehm.
Let's talk about that.
Of GeorgiaPundit.com, who's often on the show with us, and he is a DeKalb County resident, and he took a look at the early voting numbers.
So let's say that early voting started last Tuesday, so we're now into the fourth day of early voting.
Right,
so
and we're already blowing the lid off what was the ballots cast in, before the April 18th vote. But so 33,000 votes have been cast already. And he's got this note. He sent out this note in his letter this morning. He says the number out of DeKalb is alarming. That's what he called it, alarming. 9,000, almost 10,000 votes have come from DeKalb County, and the reason that's alarming is DeKalb County makes up 23% of the electorate in the 6th, and that's 29% of the early votes cast right now. That means you've got a very active Democratic get out the vote effort underway right now. And Cobb County, which is the most Republican county, the portion of the 6th district, is underperforming. It makes up something like 29% of the vote, but is only producing 20% of the early votes.
6,700 votes from Cobb County, according to Todd's figures. Fulton County has produced the most, though, early votes, according to Todd's figures, almost 17,000.
Right.
What does that tell us?
Fulton County is a correct me if I'm wrong, Loretta, that can be a 50-50
right
portion of the 6th, right?
It could. I mean, I think, you know, obviously we're talking about the northern portion of Fulton County, and that tends to run very Republican. But I think you also have, and I've talked about this before on this program, where you have a lot of new businesses, a lot of new tech companies that are drawing in a different demographic, a younger demographic, a more independent, not party-affiliated demographic. So there's a little bit of an unknown with how those new voters, if they have signed up and this is their first time voting, which way will they go? And so I think that's a calculus that we don't know about. We don't know how that's going to factor into this race.
The race gets nastier by the day. Not that it hasn't been nasty from the start tomorrow, but we now have a couple of ads on the air. I want to play you all one. Let me first, before I play you one ad, let me tell you about another one. We all know about this really offensive and entirely inappropriate video that Kathy Griffin made the other day, showing a beheaded Donald Trump. Well, John Ossoff is now in the sights of the Handle campaign tomorrow, because at one point she tweeted some time ago that she liked him as a candidate. I don't think there's been any long-term ongoing relationship there, but it was enough for the Republicans to pounce on Ossoff and accuse him of being in her camp, yes?
Oh, yeah. And this is a common strategy that we see all the time with kind of the fringe elements of both parties. Whenever some loose cannon comes out, you see the other party swoop in and try and link that to their competitor. So this isn't anything new. But
the ad says, now a celebrity John Ossoff supporter is making jokes about beheading the president of the United States. It's not funny. These angry liberals will go to any extreme to elect John Ossoff.
And yet you also had, I cannot pronounce his name, the fellow who just won the race in Montana.
Mr. Gianforte.
Who body slammed a reporter and was raising money for Karen Hammond.
Yeah,
he this
week came out and supported him. By the way, as long as we're talking about that, Tamar, do you expect any repercussions? I mean, I know Gianforte gave what has to be acknowledged is a very sincere sounding apology for that incident on the night that he won that race. And it was an odd acceptance speech. Thank you. And now I want to apologize. But is he going to face any repercussions up there at this point? What are you hearing in the halls?
I mean, you know, since the race happened, Capitol Hill's been on recess. So I haven't seen him there. But
you're right.
I'm expecting the second he's sworn in for every reporter in the world to swarm him and ask about his upcoming court date.
All right.
We'll give you a bodyguard.
If he thought he could get away from, you know, aggressive reporters, he's going to be in for a ride.
Yeah. All right. So I said that there was another ad that I think is really worth playing because it's, you know, on one hand, I get it. It's a powerful attack on Ossoff, but let's talk about whether there are certain boundaries in this sort of thing. And it actually reminds me of an old campaign ad here from years ago that had a big impact. We'll talk about that as well. But this is a spot that's being run by, I think it's Paul Ryan's PAC that's running this spot, attacking Ossoff.
This is the NRCC. This is the NRCC.
Okay, let's listen.
ISIS is infiltrating America and using Syrians to do it. The FBI warned we can't safely screen every Syrian. Yet John Ossoff's Liberal Party bosses brought 10,000 Syrian refugees to America. And Ossoff supports their dangerous Iran nuclear deal, allowing billions for the leading sponsor of terrorism. Billions that will fund terror while terrorists infiltrate and attack with our safety at risk. John Ossoff is just too risky.
All right, so, Jim, you corrected me. This not coming from Paul Ryan's PAC, but from the National Republican Campaign Committee. Their organization. You know, it sort of has, I'm curious what you all think, very different circumstances, very different target of an ad. We go back years and we remember when the Saxby-Chambliss campaign, when Chambliss was running against incumbent Democrat Max Cleland, and they went after Cleland as being soft on terror. Here's a guy who had lost three limbs in the Vietnam War. And that ad was incredibly effective, as offensive as some people found it.
Yeah, but there's a little bit difference here. I mean, and that is, and you, Bill, you know this. There's a church located in the 6th District.
Yeah.
Johnson Ferry Baptist Church.
Right.
Pastored by Bryant Wright. Everybody knows him.
Yeah, we had him on the show to talk about it.
Former president of the Southern Baptist Convention. And his church is sponsoring a group of Syrian refugees. And he was on the show with us back in January, defending the vetting processes that the NRCC is now attacking. And he was very, very supportive of these people.
All right, so Loretta, Tamar, both of you, before we take a break, help me. Or no, maybe what we'll do is let's take a break, but let me ask you a question, think about it, and we'll come back to it. We're seeing polling that shows as few as 2% of the presumed voters in the 6th District are undecided at this time. So the question is, what the heck is it with all these TV ads? What are they intended to do? I really want to hear from you on that subject, because that 2% is not many people to be throwing this much money at. So let's do this. Let's take a break. You're listening to Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
It's time for spring cleaning. Donate your used car to GPB. Just call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate online at gpb.org/cars. That's 877-GPB-1-CAR or gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Thank you for choosing Georgia Public Broadcasting. We're an 18-station radio network of GPB. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, ranked among the top universities in the nation in commitment to undergraduate teaching. I'm Ellen Reinhart.
Back on Political Rewind with Tamar Hallerman, joining us from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Washington Bureau. Are you calling us from your tiny cubicle in the Senate?
Or are today, you... it's from my apartment, so oh. We'll call it the Washington Bureau.
Loretta Lepore is here, and Jim Galloway's back from 2 weeks in Scotland. It's great to have you both here. Here's my question. If it's true that only 2% of the people in the district are undecided about who to vote for in this race, and as we get to within a couple of weeks of the election, I think we traditionally feel that people undecided this late in a race are unlikely to vote anyway, or often don't come out to vote. But let's assume they do. What is all this money? Who are the targets of these ads? I throw it out. Tamara, you want to take a crack at that? Loretta, you too?
Loretta, you go first.
I think that, you know, clearly there is an attempt to paint John Ossoff. Throughout this whole campaign, it's been about tying him to Nancy Pelosi and to the Democrats. And that ad was an ominous ad. I guess my question about that, and they're trying to, in the early voting stages and, you know, leading up, we're in a summer where people are going to be going on vacation and everybody's trying to get their voters in early. And they've unleashed this ad that has a very dark tone to it, trying to get voters to second guess their choice.
Yeah. Okay.
Right?
Right.
They want them to second guess who their choice is. And if they can do that through these ads, my concern is that it is so dark and it is so ominous, and you're dealing with a constituency that is so sophisticated, right? This is not a constituency that is uneducated to the political issues of the day.
It's one of the most educated populations.
Right. So most constituents in this district, they are aware of Syrian policy. They are aware of the Iran deal. They are reading newspapers and perhaps their own publications. And so it's not as though you have an electorate that is uninformed about some of these issues. And so it's going to be more and more difficult to change minds. And I think there could be a potential backlash from doing something so dark.
I've been interested in the fact that, I can't confirm this through any kind of data, but at least anecdotally, when I turn on the TV, I've seen certainly a lot of attack ads against Karen Handel, mostly produced by the PACs, but the ads that are produced by the Ossoff campaign, they do seem to be trying to present him in a positive light, trying to... Maybe win over some of those folks out there who normally wouldn't want to vote for a Democrat, that he's a good guy or something.
And that's clear. I mean, they're taking lessons from what happened in November, where there were a lot of Democrats who were campaigning as anti-Trump forces, and that clearly didn't work for them. So they're taking a gamble that the other direction is going to work. And I think clearly with these ads that we're seeing on both sides, they're trying to fight for those independent voters who may have voted for Obama in 2008 and 2012, but who went for Trump last year.
And then, I would agree. And I think that especially that NRCC ad, the Syrian refugee ad, that's kind of designed, if you were a Republican who's waffling, who a moderate who may be tempted to vote for John Ossoff, I think that one is intended to make you stay at home.
Okay.
To make you not cast that early ballot.
Okay, well, we're going to have a lot of time to talk about the 6th District in the weeks ahead, because June 20th is still a couple weeks out. Certainly next week we'll be talking a lot about how these debates unfold. So let's move on. Jim, let me start with you on this one, because you wrote a really interesting column the other day, the headline of which is, "In Rethinking Cuba Policy, Donald Trump Could Be Picking a Fight with Georgia Farmers." We know that the Trump administration is considering reversing the opening to Cuba that President Obama put in place, establishing relations with Cuba. And we think maybe the moment he would want to announce that would be on a trip to Miami later this month. You're saying his own agriculture secretary and our former governor, Sonny Perdue, may stand on the other side of him.
Yeah. What a lot of people don't realize is that Georgia agriculture in particular has been kind of one of the leading, they've walked the point on when it comes to opening trade to Cuba. probably more than maybe more than any other state in the South, certainly. You had Tommy Ervin making a trip there, I think, in the year 2000. Georgia began sending poultry over there in 2002.
Tommy was the legendary agriculture
The 6 foot seven, 6 foot seven Democratic state agriculture.
I think he held that job for 127 years.
I think for something like that. And you've got, and then you had Sonny Perdue in the last year of his second term. He made a trip over to the Cuba. And that was a very rare move for a Republican governor to do. And he was intent on selling Georgia goods to Cuba.
And there's, you know, we should mention for folks that aren't familiar that there was a provision in the law, you know, that allowed for agricultural goods to be sold to Cuba, even with the sanctions in place. So, because one of the questions I always get is, how could they do that when we had sanctions?
But it was a cash up front system.
Right.
And
right.
It still is.
Right. And I would say that during the presidential primary, the Georgia farm community, agriculture community, was very vocal on the Cuba issue. Many of the nominees in the race, in the primary, were expressing a similar posture, right? We're not going to open relations. We're going to turn them back. Whether it was Marco Rubio, Carly had that position. We're going to reexamine that. And we heard from the Georgia agricultural community about, let us explain to you why that's not a good idea. Let us explain to you why this is so important. And so I think that we will hear, and obviously, you know, Governor Perdue, Secretary Perdue now, old habit there. He's traveling, you know, he's on the road every week traveling and meeting with agricultural community across the state. And the one thing that he did say, I happened to see him last week, one of the things that he did say is that the issues tend to be rather similar across the country to ag. So I would imagine that while we may be a primary exporter to Cuba in terms of poultry and other products, that other agricultural communities across the country are going to feel likewise to potential opening additional markets.
Okay, so we're going to have, it's going to be interesting to watch how Perdue handles that.
Yeah, basically this is going to be U.S. agriculture versus Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, and maybe one or two House members from Florida.
Sure, of course. Their constituents are going to give them all the room they need to be supportive of whatever if the president decides to roll back the opening. But then you're going to have this business opposition. Delta Airlines tomorrow is now open to ticket office in Havana.
Exactly. And I think they're banking on the fact that if anybody's going to be sympathetic to the business case, it's our businessman president, Donald Trump. And let me just say,
that worked out really well with the Paris Accord.
Yeah, that's true. But let me just say, you know, taking a step back here on Capitol Hill, for me at least, this is one of the issues where I think you really have seen opinions start to shift rapidly. I used to write about the budget, and I used to spend weeks going through and reading these spending bills. And even when Republicans were in charge, you were starting to see more and more provisions slipped into page 973. Trying to open up Cuba to ag, trying. A lot of these guys from southern states, one of the leaders is a guy from Arkansas who sees a lot of potential for rice and being able to export their rice. You're seeing that now with Georgia and poultry. This really is becoming a rural issue. So I think we're going to see a ton of movement on it.
Okay, let me take a couple of tweets. As usual, I've let far too much time go by in the show without reminding you that you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. So please do, and a lot of you already have. Shorn Sanity, that's the handle, says, Georgia's six conservative ads seem to be a lot of confefe at this point, promoting the GOP agenda as opposed to rallying behind Handel. We're going to talk about that in just a minute, actually. Angela Ford, GOP attacks Ossoff with ugly ads because he's a Democrat. Dems can return the favor and say Karen Handel is a rubber stamp for 45. And then she says, talk issues, speaking to the candidates and their campaigns up there. Dave tweets, coal jobs, 70,000 renewable jobs, 3 million. He says we're regressing. Let me just summarize it. That and we're going to talk about the Paris Climate Accord in a minute. But he basically says that there are more renewable jobs out there than there are in the coal industry. Alan Fox says, love hearing at Loretta Lepore. She is completely right on message discipline, the hallmark of a sophisticated campaign. You've got a big fan out there.
Oh, thank you, Alan.
All right. We're going to talk. Let's do this before we go to another break, because we want to spend some time after this talking about Georgia reaction to the president's speech yesterday, what the implications are perhaps here in Georgia. But before we do, let's catch up on a couple other quick Georgia political notes. Jim, we have a brand new Republican candidate declaring for the governor's office.
We have Mike Williams.
And people don't know who that is.
He is a two-term state senator out of Forsyth County. He is the co-chair. He was the co-chair of the 2016 Trump campaign in Georgia.
Yeah, yeah, but not known to the voters. He is going to run, Loretta, as a staunch Trump supporter, and seems to believe that the Trump victory makes it clear that there are openings for people who are wild cards to actually win a race.
Well, I mean, I guess theoretically that is the case. And I think that Seth Weathers, who was also an early Trump supporter, is running his campaign. And I think, you know, when I saw this news came out and I saw the story, I had to think for a second about what's happening this weekend. I know we're going to get to that, but what's happening this weekend in Augusta, and the fact that the primary goal of this year's meeting is going to be to elect a new party chair. And I think we're going to see that be a barometer in a lot of different respects of how Georgia Republican politics is going to move forward, depending on who the leader of the party becomes. And we'll know coming out of there what kind of weight Trump has to some extent with the base of the party, the grassroots.
Yes. And in just a minute, I do want to talk a little bit about the Republican convention, state convention out in Augusta. But one other quick note, Stacey Abrams, the minority leader in the House, is set to announce formally. She's already formed a committee, an exploratory committee. Tomorrow, she's going to be down in Albany, where she is going to announce formally that she is a candidate for governor. Of course, on the Democratic side, Stacey Evans, her colleague in the state house, is already in the race, too. This is starting to focus a bit, and it's giving us another year of really fun politics.
Right, right. You've got in Daugherty County, down Albany Way, is an appropriate place to start. A big African-American vote down there, but also any Democrat who expects to win statewide is going to have to at least take a large bite out of rural Georgia.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you can see are already starting there. The other thing, the one thing you didn't mention, Bill, was Jason Carter. Is not going to run, and he has declared himself neutral.
Yeah, yeah. Well, smart decision, perhaps. If he's not going to run, better that he should to say he's neutral at this point. All right, let's talk just for a minute. In some ways, it's inside baseball, but this audience loves politics. So the Republicans are meeting in their state convention out there in Augusta. They do have a chair. When's the chairman vote?
It'll be on Saturday afternoon.
It's on Saturday. They got, four candidates running for chairman. Is Loretta already kind of set this up. Is the choice of the chairman going to tell us something about how Republicans are feeling about where they stand with Trump?
What it's going to do is tell us how Trump has changed the race for chairmanship. You've got in this race, you've got John Watson, a lobbyist. You've got Michael McNeely, the first vice chair and an African-American. You've got Mike Welsh, former chairman of the 12th District. And you've got Alex Johnson, a DeKalb County attorney. He's run twice for the seat. Now, the interesting ones there are Watson and McNeely. Okay, Watson, is as I said, he's a lobbyist. His clients have included casinos. Normally, that kills you in any kind of Republican contest. But we now have a fellow in the White House who has owned several casinos and put his name on others. It is, how can you say it's a bad thing when you're supporting the president, okay? The other part of that is Donald Trump kind of he killed the GOP effort to really broaden the GOP base. I mean, he intensified his pursuit of the white vote. Now, what we're going to have to find out is whether Republicans in Georgia want to do the same, and or whether they'll vote for the first African American chairman that the party's ever had.
Is this race pretty much up in the air?
I think it is up in the air because you have four candidates,
yeah,
right? And I think, you know, you can't discount support that Alex Johnson has either, because he has run twice before, so people know him.
Picking up fresh votes each time.
Right. And so, you know, and I will say in full disclosure, I'm a supporter of John Watson's. And so, I don't want to mislead.
You were on the same Purdue team at the governor's.
Right. He was the chief of staff when I was press secretary. And, you know, I know John to be a solid conservative. I know him to be, a good Republican. But I think what the choice will come down to here is pragmatism versus ideology, because John is approaching this race with a very pragmatic view and a standpoint of where is the party today and what do we need to do to marshal our resources to maintain the Republican majority in Georgia.
Well, moreover, the party is in dire financial straits.
That's what I was going to say.
Well, that's what I was saying. I was being too diplomatic about that.
Right.
But it is. I mean, our dirty laundry has been aired, and
party's
we know.
Bankrupt. And, broke, essentially.
Right. And so there's that. And then there's also, how do you prepare for races and define what the party is going to be moving forward when you have a 6-district race, which even if John Ossoff doesn't win this race, it's an opening. It's a crack for one of the Stacys to walk through. And that's what the Democrats are counting on. And that's what John is saying. We have got to shore up.
Okay.
Now, Michael McNeely is running as an ideologue, a conservative ideologue.
He's supporting religious liberty.
Right. So in a pointing out his social conservative credentials to that point.
Okay. Well, we're going to watch how that turns out. Jim Galloway, I know you're heading down there right after the show is off the air.
And Loretta will be, too.
And you'll be there as well. Tomorrow, you and I, we're not going to be at the party.
Oh, you poor guy.
Let's do this. Let's get another break out of the way and come back and talk about President Trump, talk about his speech on Paris Treaty yesterday, and much more. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
NIH Director Francis Collins joins soprano Renee Fleming on stage this weekend. It's an exploration of music, health, and science. They got the idea at a dinner party.
He said, do you think that we could collaborate, put something together to amplify the work being done in this field? And he didn't hesitate.
What an opportunity.
I'm Robert Siegel, collaborating on music and the mind this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon from 4 to 7 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Tamar Hallerman, Loretta Lepore, Jim Galloway on the panel today. All right. Well, tell you what, before we do this, let me make a quick announcement that we're really excited about, and I don't want to run out of time to do this. In about a month, we are going to be adding an hour to our presence during the week on GPB Radio. We're going to start broadcasting Two-Way Street, the show that we've been doing on the weekends. The first run of our show is now going to be on Thursday afternoons at 2 o'clock. So you'll hear a Political Rewind Monday, Wednesday, Friday. But on Thursday, if you tune in at 2, you'll hear Two-Way Street, a show which many of you tell us you listen to in addition to our Political Rewind show. So I hope you will join us. That starts Thursday, July 6th. We'll still rebroadcast the show on Sunday mornings at 11 for people who like to listen to it.
Nugget, you're just taking over the place.
We're just... All right. Tamar Hallerman. So everybody who listens to the show has heard 18. You've heard all the sound you could possibly want to hear. I have one sound bite I'm going to play at some point. So we know that Trump is now out of the Paris Accord. We know it's caused a big stir among many people who think it's going to lead us down a path to destroying the planet. But let's talk about it a little bit more calmly, I hope. How are Georgians up there? What have you heard as you've talked to people in our delegation?
It's fallen along pretty typical partisan lines here. All the Republicans I've spoken to have, or at least the ones who wanted to comment publicly, have had nothing but nice things to say about the president. They say it'll help keep our industry, we won't be held back by any international agreement, other countries, telling us what to do. And they also say that Obama should have sought Senate confirmation back when they did, and any new contract or any new agreement that President Trump should strike, they think the Senate should approve, which of course they won't approve anything. And then you have the Democrats saying this is a terrible idea. And most notably, you have Kasim Reed, the mayor of Atlanta, saying he's going to continue adhering to the Paris Treaty. He's going to continue to reduce carbon emissions and to try and move forward with that. And then you also have the 6th District candidates following along pretty typical partisan lines.
Karen Handel
as well.
Thinks it was a good idea and a good speech, and John Ossoff doesn't.
Yeah, he was saying history will judge us very harshly for leaving. So pretty different views there.
Is this an issue voters are going to, is this going to have any impact on the voters up there at all, do we think? Or is it just another example of you're either for or against Trump? This either confirms your love for what he's doing, or it confirms for you that he's the wrong guy for the job, and you'll express that at the polls in the 6th.
Exactly. I find that this, I don't think this will have much of an impact. There was some polling done before the election in November that said only about 2% of voters listed the environment as their number one issue. I think voters are much more concerned about the economy, much more concerned about national security. This falls pretty low on the list for most people.
So while I know there's been some breathless response to this from those who really support the accord, it seems to me this break, there's two different buckets to put this in, and at least go with me on this. There's the environmental bucket, and it appears that it's certainly not advantageous, most people would say, for the United, or many people think, for the United States to be out of the accord, but industry, business, has already stepped forward and said, we're still going to work toward the goals that the Paris Accord established. We still want to be more green. We still want to work on renewable energy. And the United States will probably continue to reduce carbon emissions, that sort of thing. And local governments are stepping forward. So is the impact more on the political side or the environmental side? The political side, it's Trump putting a thumb into the eye of the rest of the world, and that seems to have more significant implications.
I would call that the diplomatic bucket rather than the political.
Okay.
And what I would do is I would ask you to look at that with his confrontation with NATO leaders last week, because what you're really seeing is a fracturing between the U.S. And Europe. Do you know what? You know what we're going to be celebrating 1 year from tomorrow, Bill?
I don't.
The 70th anniversary of the Marshall Plan.
Oh, all right.
And I just cannot think of a more disparate comparison between what Donald Trump has done vis-a-vis relations with Europe in the last 2 weeks, and what post-World War II America did when it recognized that it couldn't survive without a healthy Europe.
Yeah. And I think your hypothesis, the way that you drew the line between the two different issues at hand here, is exactly how the debate broke down in the White House from all the reporting, right? So you had the Secretary of State and the Pentagon chief on one side of the aisle arguing about how this would impact diplomacy abroad. And then in the other side, you had, you know, Steve Bannon and whoever was in his corner advocating that this is about jobs, this was a campaign promise, this is an economic argument. And so that's how that broke down, you know, in that internal discussion as well. I think that you are right about business proceeding because, as you know, Roger Tutterow was quoted in the AJC by Russell Grantham
Tell
in his
everybody
article
who he is.
Today. And so Roger Tutterow is an economist with Kennesaw State and well respected. And, you know, and his argument was, you know, not to make so much of this because business is going to feel the demand from its customers to continue on this path toward becoming green, reverting to clean energy. And then you see a company that's also quoted in this article, Southern Company, saying we're moving away already from coal. We're going to continue that down that path because it's the right thing to do. It's for their businesses, it's the right thing to do, and it meets their bottom line. So I think there is a lot of hyperbole right now here domestically. But I think when tempers kind of settle a little bit and we're able to re-engage in a very productive conversation, we can find a way to come to a solution that works for this country.
The other part of that is formal U.S. withdrawal cannot occur until 2020, until the day after the next inauguration day.
Yeah, that's the terms of the accord. And the White House has At least they told the New York. The New York Times has reported that they are going to comply with that provision.
So you could have an entire presidential election revolve around this in the end.
All right. I want to play one soundbite that really stood out for me and ask you all to react to it. As I said, I think everybody who listens to our show has heard many, many soundbites coming out of the speech that the president gave in the Rose Garden yesterday. But this one really stood out for me, and I want to ask you if you all agree with the way I interpreted this.
At what point does America get demeaned? At what point do they start laughing at us as a country? We want fair treatment for its citizens, and we want fair treatment for our taxpayers. We don't want other leaders and other countries laughing at us anymore, and they won't be. They won't be.
All right. To me, this was Donald Trump and his own psychological frame of reference extending that to the country at large. We don't want to be laughed at.
His view of diplomacy is very akin to the Manhattan real estate market, I think. And what strikes me, what struck me about that speech, Bill, was that, you know, I've always found it one of the many ironies of the 2016 election was that with conservative evangelicals supported Donald Trump. So your conservative Christians were really supporting the fellow who believed most fervently in social Darwinism, because that's his view of diplomacy. It is survival of the fittest. And I just find that very odd.
Does that strike you? I mean, well, this is a guy who we've always been told came from Queens to try to establish himself in Manhattan. As well as he's done, he's never quite felt as he's been accepted by New York society. And this seemed to be an extension of that to what our whole country is dealing with here.
Right. And you know, I'm not a psychologist, but I view this more from a communications vantage point. We talked about message discipline at the beginning of the show. And what struck me about his remarks yesterday, I listened to it live, was there was so little discipline and the messaging was so off. I think, whether or not you agree with the withdrawal from the accord or not, the case could have been made much more succinctly, and it could have been made in a way that gave the president more gravitas in his decision-making process. What was most concerning to me was, why are the people that are advising him not being more instructive or more helpful in disciplining that message? Well, and this was an opportunity where he was reading off the prompter. This was not like he went out to a campaign event. It was not like he was speaking off the cuff. I mean, this was a big global speech that everybody was going to be watching, yet it just seemed a little too free-flowing.
Boy, it's interesting. Go ahead, Tamara. Yeah, I do too.
I totally disagree. I was an energy reporter my first job out of school. I used to write a ton about this stuff. And he took this really complicated idea, right? In the climate negotiations for years and years and years, the debate was whether countries that have always emitted a lot of carbon, countries like the U.S., historically large industrialized states, whether they were responsible for cutting their emissions more than other states that are industrializing now, like India, like China. That's a really hard argument to sell to the common person, your average Joe who's not up on this stuff every day. And I think Trump found a really good way to explain that to somebody and to sell his point to the people who matter to him.
Well, I want to split the difference. I kind of agree with each of you in different ways. I thought, Loretta, that he couldn't have been more on point with his own constituents. It was for him all about jobs that we're losing. A lot of the data that he introduced yesterday has already been called into question by a number of different news organizations. But I thought that 38%,
right? But
that's not
the quote you played here today.
That's
to my
right.
point,
right.
You played the point about the quote about him talking about the world laughing
Fair.
At us.
Yeah.
And that's my point, is that there was too much in those remarks that opened the door for the media to play on him like they have been doing for months and months.
Yeah.
And so what I'm saying is, with a more disciplined approach, you don't open that door for people to pull out quotes like that.
Fair enough. We're almost out of time. But, Jim, here's one of these moments to me, what I thought about watching the speech yesterday, is here's one of those moments where the fact that we no longer seem to respect facts really hurts us in how we try to interpret a decision as important as this was and the way in which it was presented. There are many, many flaws, apparently, with how the president presented this what the Paris Accord was all about. The biggest one being he created the impression that this was something that these standards were put into place and the United States was forced to accept them. Each country voluntarily set its own standards.
Right.
And at any moment, it's a loose enough accord that countries are allowed to go back in and say, we want to change our the standards that we've set for the goals we've set for
ourselves. There was a single line in his speech where he said that the Paris Accord was both non-binding and draconian.
Yeah. So, and here's
but here's the emphasis that you're putting on this is that this was countries deciding, i.e., a former president deciding. This was not something that went through the U.S. Senate,
where it
should have gone. So, you know, at the bottom of all of this, you know, is the fact of, should major policy decisions for our country be made by executive order, or should it have gone through the U.S. Senate where the people have a say? And Donald Trump was speaking to the people. He was speaking to not only his constituents, but framing it in a way that I'm always going to be the guardian of the people.
I will agree with that if I see Donald Trump make a presentation to Congress saying, this is what we should. This is what the Paris Accord should require us to do, and this is what I'm asking you to approve. Otherwise, I think we're in for a season of singular presidential policy.
I am afraid we are completely out of time for today's show. I've got to end it now. Tamar Hallerman, Loretta Lepore, Jim Galloway, thanks for a really good conversation today. And again, Jim, welcome back from your vacation. My thanks to everybody in the control room for your great work getting this show on the air today. And we should welcome Peyton Hawkins. She is our new intern here for the summer, and we're really glad to have you here, Peyton. Jenny, Olivia, Tyler, Lisa, thank you for everything you've done for the show today. We're back on Monday at 2 o'clock, and Jim Galloway will be here with me, and so will Theron Johnson, the Democrat, and Brian Robinson, the Republican. It's always fun when they're together on the show. Have a great weekend. See you all on Monday.